This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're driving over an overpass smack in the middle of Carson, California. You look down and you can see the Dominguez Channel. It cuts the city of Carson in half, and it's filled with stormwater runoff. Crack open the car window, especially at night, and you can smell it.
Rotten eggs, sulfur, like somebody got up in the sky and just let out a big loud poop, and it's just stuck in the air.
Lakeisha Coleman lives about a mile and a half south of that channel. In September, when the smell started, she got a prescription for migraine headache medication. Some of her neighbors were complaining of dizziness, double vision, nausea. Coleman became so uncomfortable, she went to the emergency room.
And I told my doctor what was going on, and he said, oh my God, stop taking the medicine, get out of your neighborhood.
LA County has declared a state of emergency. They've paid for thousands of hotel rooms, so residents like Coleman can escape that toxic odor hovering over Carson. But the county will stop paying for those rooms this week. They say it's now safe for residents to come home. Coleman is back in Carson. She still smells the gas and gets daily headaches. And meanwhile, her elderly parents just flew in to spend Thanksgiving with her. KCRW's Kaylee Wells picks up the story from here.
Even when Coleman was in one of the subsidized hotels, she was just trading in a literal headache for a metaphorical one. She got placed in Long Beach. Her adult children who live with her got placed at LAX. Then she left for a few days. She spent some time at her kids' hotel room, which was closer to her job.
And they involuntarily checked me out. I had no idea. Now my things are still missing. I'm still fighting with the hotel trying to figure out where my things are. It's just a mess. It's a mess.
She tried to get a new hotel room for her and her small dog, but the next one available had a $250 pet fee the county would not pay. So while her adult children are sleeping out by LAX, after a month of moving around, Coleman went home. Even if you do score a room where the pet can stay for free, keeping it is tougher than it sounds. Luz Padua has been staying in Torrance. She's on room number 3. Padua is legally blind, so every time she gets relocated, she has to relearn the layout of the room she's living in.
It's gone down.
I'm so sorry. There's two big
bumps. There's two, yeah. No, this one's gone down. It was. I've been icing it all morning. It was more significant than that.
The golf ball-sized bumps on her leg came from running into a dresser that morning. Even once she found a room that worked for her family, there was no guarantee she would keep it. The county's contracts with the hotel each only run for 1 week, Friday to Friday. So you don't know how long you'll get your room. You might get a call at 10 a.m. on a Friday asking you to check out by noon.
We were guessing, like, are we staying? Are we going? What's happening? We'd get a call, oh, you've been extended. Then I'd get a call, oh, you're going to relocate. Then I'd get a call, no, you're going to stay. It's been very stressful.
The city of Carson initially helped residents figure out where to stay. But then after several weeks, the city stopped helping, leaving them to cope with the county's chaotic system. Carson's mayor, Lula Davis-Holmes, says the city did all it could.
Well, it's the county's problem, and they want to be the one to solve it. You know, and it's just like me going to your house and saying, I'm going to handle everything that's wrong in your house. This is their problem. And they've asked us to step back.
Now, many residents who are home already say it doesn't smell as bad as it used to. And that's mostly because the county is spraying 13,000 gallons of odor neutralizer on the channel every day. But Coleman says when the wind dies down at night, it comes back.
When I'm here all day, all night, my nose is bleeding. Sometimes I'm awakened out of my sleep because of the smell, coughing and choking.
There's several agencies that have been investigating for weeks why the channel smells. The leading wisdom right now is hydrogen sulfide. That's a toxic gas that smells like rotten eggs. It can come from oil wells or bacteria in stagnant water. Some residents blame a 4.3 earthquake centered in Carson that shook their homes and the oil refineries there in mid-September. But
we have found no evidence that the earthquake is a cause of this ongoing incident.
Terrence Mann with the Air Quality Management District says all evidence so far points to the roughly 29 million gallons of dead water with decaying plant matter in the channel, which hasn't been flushed out thanks to our drought.
And the prevailing theory among the entire group of agencies is that this is essentially a naturally occurring incident. And so it is a die-off in the channel.
They keep saying it's a natural occurrence, but this has never happened. They said it's because of the drought. We've had plenty of droughts before. Never smelt this. Never.
The county's Department of Public Works has also blamed the drought for the smell. No one there granted us an interview for this story. When asked at a recent public meeting to explain the cause of the smell, they said the investigation is ongoing, and then explained why there's not enough water to flush out the channel.
We need essentially like a wave action, like almost like a huge shadow wave action. So we also
Director Mark Pastrella says the ocean tide at the end of the channel pushes the water back in, and the channel can't be dredged.
Each of those solutions came up that we came up with had problems with one, feasibility, the actual feasibility to put the dredge in there. Two, some of the risks that were associated with that discharge weren't acceptable.
Pastrella says instead they're using industrial sewage and sanitation methods to treat the water. He says it should fix the problem for good. It's just going to take a while. Coleman is not satisfied with that answer. She wonders if the city's demographics, it's 24% Black and 37% Latino, make the situation less urgent for county officials.
I honestly feel that if this was more of a less minority community, that something would have happened already. It just makes no sense that we have to wait so long to get answers, and we still don't have any answers. None whatsoever. You know, what are they going to do to prevent this from happening again?
At the worst point, the amount of hydrogen sulfide in the air was about 200 times what's federally allowed. Today, it's consistently under that standard almost everywhere, almost all the time. That's why the county will stop paying for hotel rooms by Friday, even though complaints of smelly air and daily headaches from residents continue. Padua and her family were planning to travel for the Thanksgiving holiday, but instead they'll be staying in town to pack up their lives and head home. As for Coleman,
I have family coming in from Thanksgiving. I don't know what I'm going to do with them.
She's crossing her fingers that her parents don't get sick while they visit her in Carson. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving forward now in gear with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. After a year off, thanks COVID, the LA Auto Show, which by the way dates back to 1907, practically the dawn of the automobile, is back in action now. As usual, there's a bunch of new car offerings and related stuff spread out all across the LA Convention Center. What has changed is the stuff under the hood, if there even is a hood or a fossil fuel burning engine under that hood. You see, the spotlight has shifted now from internal combustion engines to EV, electric vehicles. And here to update us on the auto show and to find out whether EVs are ready for their close-up is our science, tech, and car guy, Todd Mazzaro. Todd, welcome back to you.
Hello, Steve. Great to be here.
And welcome back to the auto show, by the way. I want to do a quick primer into EVs. How are they different from regular gas and oil burning cars?
Well, first of all, EVs, electric vehicles, they don't really have an engine. And that's a big deal because all of a sudden, there's a bunch more room, potentially. It means you can redesign the vehicle in a pretty big way. It also means there are a whole lot fewer moving parts and things that can break down. So owners don't have to visit their mechanics very often. Or maybe in the future, they'll be called automotive electricians.
What about the whole charging thing, Todd? I mean, I know that's been a big stumbling block for a lot of, I think about it when I think, I bought a hybrid. And, you know, when I think about making that next step to electric vehicle, I always think about the charging availability. When I'm on the road, if I'm going on a long road trip or whatever, am I going to be able to find a charger? I mean, that's real world stuff, right?
Absolutely. And that is the question. But one of the benefits of an EV is that you can actually charge the car right at home, even with a standard 110 volt outlet, which does take a long time because it's low voltage. But the fastest charging I've ever seen is with a level 3, the fastest charger type. There's 1, 2, and 3 with a large, fast battery in the EV. With that setup, you can go from 0% charge to 80% in about 20 minutes. So that's a bit slower than gassing up a car with an internal combustion engine. But, you know, these vehicles are getting 300, even up to 520 miles on a single charge. So you have a lot of distance you can travel before you have to worry about it. And that's way more than enough for regular commuters.
You know, EVs have been a thing at the LA Auto Show for the past few years. We've seen electric cars there, but it seems like they've really picked up some steam this year. I mean, what's going on?
Well, you know, steam was one of the three technologies at the dawn of the automobile. And there was a car called a Stanley Steamer, and that company lasted until the mid-20s. But there are a bunch of reasons why EVs right now are suddenly having their moment. One, you know, is the success that Tesla is enjoying. And it's not just their stock price. They keep increasing their production and their sales. They made and sold around 500,000 cars last year. And so far this year, they're past 627,000 cars on their way to an anticipated 900,000 that they think will be sold by the end of this year. And they're currently the number one market capitalization car maker in the world, worth more than $1.13 trillion. That's with a T, dollars. More than Toyota, more than Volkswagen, more than any automobile manufacturer.
Those, of course, are, you know, because of stock prices, right? I mean, that's market capitalization, is how much people
Correct.
Have invested in the company, right? But big numbers, big numbers. Didn't Lucid, Todd, the EV startup, just pass Ford for market cap?
They did, and General Motors. And they're another California car company headquartered in Newark up in the Bay Area. They're worth $90 billion, and they were named the Motor Trend Car of the Year for 2022, which is a pretty big deal. Their first offering, the Air, has a range of 520 miles. They're delivering the car called the Dream Edition that has a sticker price of $169,000, and wow. They will sell 500 cars this year.
At $169,000 a pop.
Yep. But, you know, while we're on the topic of California EV companies, we have to also talk about Rivian, which is a pickup and SUV-focused manufacturer. Their headquarters are in Irvine, down in Orange County, and they went public just a few weeks ago, and they're now ranked number 5 in market cap. They also are worth more than General Motors, Ford, and Daimler, which includes Mercedes-Benz, and also Lucid, Rivian's SUV. Their first car starts at $70,000, and the pickup that they sell just under $68,000. So far this year, they've delivered more than 100 of each of those cars.
All right, so they've delivered a couple hundred cars. They're already worth more than GM and Ford and Mercedes. How does that make any sense? Again, it's the stock price, but...
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense, but as you say, it's the stock market. And what it really means, though, is that there are a lot of people who conceptually believe that electric vehicles are the future, and they want to be a part of that future and share in the growth of those companies by buying stock.
So, all right, a lot of electric cars at the LA Auto Show. What else can you see there?
Well, there are a bunch of newcomers and world premieres. I mean, Mullen is a new EV that's being made in Mississippi with headquarters, you know, where else? Here in Southern California, in Brea. Ford is showing its fully electric F-150 Lightning pickup truck. Toyota showed their first all-electric, the BZ4X, really catchy name. And Fisker has their first all-electric car, which is called the Ocean. A new company called Canoe has what they call a lifestyle vehicle and characterized as a loft on wheels. Because remember, like we talked about, there's no internal combustion engine, which means there's a lot more space to play with inside the shape of a normal car. And in the lobby of the South Hall, I saw another brand new EV option called the Indy. Their headquarters are in Vernon. And I spoke with Andre Hudson, who's their head of design and product. He's excited about the opportunity to essentially reinvent the car, which he thinks of as a computer on wheels.
It's really a digital device that happens to transport you from A to B. But we're able to actually put a supercomputer, what we're calling a supercomputer, in the vehicle, or as we like to refer to it as a VIC, a vehicle integrated computer, into the car that runs parallel to the vehicle's control systems.
So what's behind the seemingly massive across-the-board push, Todd Mazzaro, push toward EVs? I mean, they're still pretty small as far as a percentage of car sales, right?
They are. They are a very small percentage overall. But you'll see more of them here in California. By some accounts, nearly half of all the EVs sold in the U.S. are sold right here, Steve. But that's still just a tiny fraction of the 12 million cars sold this year so far. I asked Stephanie Brindley, is an automotive principal analyst at IHS Market, about the source of this EV onslaught.
Right now, it's more regulation than it is anything else. What's happened in the last 24 months is that I think automakers had to kind of decide which way they were going to go. And a combination of the Paris Climate Accord, regulations getting stiffer, there is a push to this general direction.
What about environmental issues with the EV cars, Todd? In the big picture, electric vehicles will help us fight climate change by reducing carbon emissions. They're not like just innocuous to the environment, right?
Absolutely right. So the first question is, where does the energy come from that charges the car? You know, some states that have coal-fired electric plants means that an efficient gasoline engine may be less polluting than an electric vehicle. But luckily, we're moving in the direction of more renewable sources like solar and wind. And what fuels those batteries also could become an issue too. 70% of the cobalt that's used in the batteries is mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where miners use hand tools and the worker conditions would never come close to passing muster with OSHA. And 50% more water goes into building an EV than a standard internal combustion engine car. So, you know, these issues are being addressed, manufacturers say. And in the long run, of course, we really do need the savings in reducing carbon emissions that EVs bring.
And, we talked about the charging issue, Todd. Who's building these charging stations? It can't just be Tesla.
Well, it's not just Tesla. Volkswagen is building a bunch of them. And the reason they're building them is because they were caught cheating on diesel emissions. The U.S. courts ordered Volkswagen to spend $2 billion on electric charging infrastructure and awareness. So that also contributed to convincing Volkswagen that they needed to go all in on EVs.
You just used the word infrastructure, and I think there was a big infrastructure bill that just passed. What about that? Is there any part of the $1.2 trillion allocated for EVs?
There is, actually. $7.5 billion of that infrastructure bill is earmarked for building alternative fuel charging. And IHS Market estimates that'll lead to some 400,000 chargers by 2026.
In the near future, what percentage of cars, Todd, sold in this country are EVs?
It's more every day, really. And by 2025, IHS Market anticipates EV sales will jump to 40% of all vehicles sold.
And what about the chip shortage that has so many car lots pretty much empty now?
The chip shortage will be resolved, but it will remain tight through all of next year, is what I'm being told by the experts. So sometime around 2023, the chip shortage will lighten up and supplies will return to pre-COVID normal.
Todd Mazzaro, our tech and car guy. Todd, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Let's go!
All right, moving on now from the auto show to LA art shows. A couple of solo exhibitions on the east side feature artists that mix landscapes with history and mythology and more to create abstract paintings that feel mystical and real all at once. Well, one of those exhibits is its smart objects over in Echo Park. It's called Methods for Regional Stewardship and features the work of New Mexico-based artist Will Bruno. The other exhibition, called Mineral Mythology, is on display at La Loma Projects in Pasadena, featuring L.A. artist Aaron Morse. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston-Zappas, founder and editor of Carla Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, is here. She went to check those exhibits out. She's here with the Inside Scoop. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
Let's start by talking about what these two artists, Bruno and Morse, have in common. So what do you think is the through line here that brings them both into this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, just to start out, I always think it's so interesting when there are similarities between two artists' work that are on view at the same time. This work was both made within the last year. They have really overlapping themes and techniques. So to me, that kind of points us towards a larger trend, perhaps, that I'm always trying to spot between artists working in a similar time period. So Bruno and Morse are both painters. They both use painting a lot like collage, though, and I think that's what makes them really unique and similar to each other. So they're pulling from a wide array of imagery and historical narratives into their work, but then also mixing their own made-up fantasy and mythology into the work. And really, they're both pulling from historical source material in the natural world and then just collapsing all these things together into one space. And I think what's so interesting here is that both of the artists are looking to real events, real locations, real histories for references, but then using those things as sort of building blocks to invent their own narratives.
So let's start with Will Bruno and his show. This is Methods for Regional Stewardship. It's over in Echo Park at Smart Objects. How would you describe this work? I mean, you mentioned collage and, you know, I guess some ethereal stuff, right?
Totally. And his work has such a beautiful kind of ethereal color palette to it. He's in New Mexico. If you imagine the New Mexico landscape and the colors kind of, you know, a lot of earth tones and rusts, but then a lot of blues and lavenders, almost like you can imagine the weather there. So really beautifully painted landscapes that are kind of thinly painted. But then on top of that, he's collaging other figures and references. He's looking a lot at art history, but also at indigenous histories of the area and histories of colonialism and land development, in addition to fables and kind of made up fantasy. You know, like, for instance, in one painting, there's this tiny clown figure that's kind of floating above one of the landscapes, and it just makes almost no sense at all. So it's sort of, you know, pointing us to not everything here is meant to be read literally. We can travel into fantasy as much as we're looking at real places and events.
Let's talk about Aaron Morse's exhibition over at La Loma Projects in Pasadena. It's called Mineral Mythology. How does that name connect to the works themselves?
Yeah, so the work also includes landscape, but, you know, and collage references from different sources. But Morse is a little different than Bruno's, feels very geological and very ecological. So the compositions are very dense. There's so much crammed into each of his paintings, whereas I think Bruno has a little more space and breathing room. But there's this kind of productive chaos and pressure that happens in Morse's paintings, which kind of, you know, brings you to thinking about how minerals are formed and rock formations kind of being pressed together by pressure. And there is one painting called Mineral Mythology. So that's kind of where the title comes from. And, you know, it's this collage of different minerals and artifacts, Paleolithic artifacts, cave paintings that really kind of collapse together. And the gallery talks about the process of minerals being made really similar to how our collective story is being built one layer at a time. So kind of drawing a parallel there between minerals, the ecology of our world, but then also the way that we're building history and narrative.
So why do you think they're putting all these things together, Lindsay? I mean, they're using landscape and actual histories, but they're also including made up stories as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen very clearly in our society that histories are not always equitable, right? The stories are often told by the victors or the people in power. And I think both of these artists are very aware of that kind of political element. So they're pulling from actual histories, but then making them into these fantastical kind of invented histories and narratives that almost subvert the way we remember and subvert the way we tell history. And to me, this feels really hopeful. It feels like the artists are kind of considering a new way forward by using what's around us to create that. And there's this element of world building and kind of reimagining what's possible. And I think that's so, so important for us to be doing as a culture, as we can build a more equitable world in light of all the challenges that we face globally and ecologically.
Will Bruno's work is up through December 18th over at Smart Objects in Echo Park. Aaron Morse on view through January 9th at La Loma in Pasadena. Lindsay Preston-Zappas, our art insider, editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, director Paul Thomas Anderson talks about growing up in the San Fernando Valley in the 70s and 80s. His new movie, Licorice Pizza, which chronicles that time and place. You'll hear from him tomorrow. Check out kcrw.com/GLA. Check out any show. Subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a thing at kcrw.com/GLA. Or, of course, you can get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. kcrw.com/GLA. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Toss, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all had eyes and ears and hands on the product you heard this evening. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thank you for your time and your ears. Have a great night.